Welcome to the Gregarious Mammal Podcast, and this episode I'm talking to Daniel G. You seem to explicitly use it, so Daniel G. Siegel. And we met at a conference a little while back in Voxt in Belgrade. Kate and I have already spoken a little bit about that conference, but Daniel's talk was somewhat similar in, at least in motivation, to mine and some of the topics we've discussed previously on the show. So we wanted to get him on and have a discussion. So yeah, Daniel, introduce yourself and very briefly to begin with what your talk was about.
Hey Chris, great to be here and thanks for the invitation. I see you already said we met I think 2 years ago, right? Like at Vox.
Well, yeah, we've actually met both times, to be fair, yeah.
And so actually my this year's talk is a continuation of my last year's talk, which was The Lost Medium. But before I go into that, I'm a solo consultant and I help my clients with digital marketing strategies. And my vision behind my business mostly to make sense of computers, so to use a computer to actually solve real problems. Mm-hmm. And that was like the primary motivation to jump into this topic, to give those two talks. And last year's talk was mostly about the innovation process we have lost. So there were so many great projects in the 60s, in the 70s, and I highlighted some of those. And at the end of the talk, I had a feeling that I've left something out, which was, what now? And this led me to, or this question led me to give another talk to explore mostly on how we actually invent things or do innovation, how we come to the state we are right now, and what we actually are missing out by not looking to the left and to the right.
So the talk and blog post prior to it was entitled The Bullet Hole Misconception, which is a somewhat strange title for a talk on technology. So maybe you can explain where that comes from.
Well, I don't think that the name was used before my talk, but I found it such a great title, so I just stuck to it. And I'm starting my talk with a story about airplanes in World War II, where the Americans and the British military was doing like these bomber raids over Germany. And if you look at the statistics, they were losing like a lot of people, a lot of airplanes. There were heavy battles over the skies over Germany. You can imagine like flak and enemy fighter airplanes and friendly fire and so on. And there are these crazy stories that sometimes people were thrown off the planes just to and they were hoping like being caught by the enemy and sent to a POW camp, for example, and so on. And I think the average survival rate was like maybe 50%, but in like, especially in the beginning, it was a lot less, maybe like 10%. So it was similar to like the First World War. And of course the military was trying to improve those statistics. And of course, if you're trying to make an airplane safer, at least a military airplane, you're always trying to add armor, but of course you can't arm the whole airplane. Otherwise it won't take off. So the question was where to put the additional armor. And they looked at all the returning airplanes and did some plots, some maps, and overlaid the bullet holes on each airplane and found out the main the worst areas on the plane were the fuselage, the outer wings, and the tail. And of course, they wanted to reinforce those damaged areas. And there was a statistician who was working on those kind of problems. And they asked him about, like, if you can just, like, have a look at their results and see if you can improve anything. And he just told me, it's completely wrong what you're doing. Because if a plane makes it back safely with, say, bullet holes in a fuselage, it meant those bullet holes weren't very dangerous at all, you know?
Yeah.
So actually, the bullet holes in the engines or in the cockpits or all those areas where there were virtually no bullet holes, those are the the really sensitive parts of the plane. Mm. And that finding helped to at least improve the statistics for those people. Some people say it helped to turn the tide of war. But generally, that was the interesting thing for me, that the stakes were so high back then. You know, we're talking about the fate of a nation or like the world war, and they were doing like such a stupid mistake. And this led me to question like what stupid mistakes are we doing in our professional lives, and especially when we're talking about computers.
It's also actually interesting because I sort of read a couple of anecdotes from the Second World War, especially where one big advantage the British especially had was that they were more open to crazy ideas. And this actually, in some respects, was a success because no one expected them a lot of the time. I wonder if that's a little bit of the your point as well, in that maybe at the moment we are too afraid to, maybe afraid's a bad word. We're making software, but we don't want to take too many risks. We want to stick to common patterns, and we only change ideas when everyone else does it. And we're worried that people will criticize us for taking a crazy idea that isn't kind of part of the current cool sort of mantra. I don't know. I'm not sure if I'm trying to draw too many parallels, but
I think I can. We can talk about lots of things right here, because first of all, and that was the point of my first talk. There's so many great ideas out there, and even like in the 90s, even like 5 years ago, and even now, we have some people who are like coming up with crazy solutions and really cool ways to interact with computers, great ideas, and so on. Just like mostly they are ignored. That wasn't the case, I don't think, like 4 years ago, 50 years ago. You know, people were coming into computers back then, and from different fields, like I don't know, biology or literature or physics and so on. And they were trying to solve their own problems, thinking about like how can a computer help me to make my life better. And now it's just like, okay, we got the new iPhone, and that's it. So and this is what innovation is like these days. And of course, it's easy to say that. It's a whole different thing if you pick a career in IT and you're, I don't know, a project manager, designer, programmer, and so on. You have a family at home, you have bills to pay, and so on. And your boss tells you, like, we need the new website up to it tomorrow. Like, there's no time to be creative and think about, like, what other things could we do?
So do you feel that maybe a lot of it has to do with the maturity of the space now, that there was an element in the past, and I think I caught the tail end of it. I started working in web development in the late 90s, where, to be honest with you, no one had a clue what you did. So you could claim something took four times as long as it really did because you wanted to try out some new technique, and people would just say, okay, yeah, whatever, you know, I don't know anything. And that's changed a bit, which in some respects is a positive,
right.
because that kind of cult of knowledge is a dangerous thing in itself. But that now a lot of people maybe are more informed and can say, well, you know, we need this website up tomorrow, and I know you can do it, so
right.
just do it.
I mean, the interesting question here is always why.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's really really easy to get up with a, I don't know, web app or something like that, just look at the JavaScript infrastructure, npm, node, and so on. Like, you have everything available. It's just a matter of installing the right packages, and you're off to go. The interesting thing here, though, is like, why do you need a website, for example? And that's a really interesting thing I ask my client. Like, often people come to me and tell me, like, we need a new website. And my first reaction is always like, why? Yeah, because we need to attract new customers. Yeah, but why?
Yeah.
And if you ask the why like four or five times, you come up with something where the website is not the best solution for this thing. I mean, I don't want to say like you don't need a website at all. It's just like for a specific problem, there are other ways to do things.
Yeah.
And just to give you an example, like a few weeks ago, I've been to a small management consulting firm, and they were telling me, like, we need a website with 10,000 visitors a month and so on. And I told them, it's possible, but why do you need it? And they're actually coming up with that thing that they need new customers, new leads, and so on. And we were looking at the statistics or analytics of their website. They had about 300 visitors a month.
Okay, yeah.
And what was really interesting to me is that the CEO was an avid speaker. He was at conferences like at least 2 to 3 times a month. Mm. And we actually lined up his calendar with the analytics of the website and match up perfectly.
Okay.
Even with the audience size and so on. And so I just told him, like, the easiest thing would be not to do a new website, but to create something of value, maybe like a summary of the presentation or a follow up, a small ebook, something like that, and give that to the people after the presentation. Mm. And then they're actually solving real problems for what he's talking about for their clients and so on.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing which is mostly lost. We don't ask why anymore. And it's just like, this is the best way we can do things.
I don't know. I think we do ask why, but maybe we ask why in a different context. We ask why after that point. Like, you need a new website.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Why is someone coming to this website? Not sure. Why do you even want a website in the first place? Yeah, maybe
right.
That's, we do ask why a lot, but maybe at the wrong time is the, yeah.
Yeah, that might be a better explanation.
Yeah. And actually now, just coming through your post, because you mentioned also the invention of the printing press, which is a particular sort of favorite point in history of mine, because I often think that when people now say, you know, the internet is such a marvel of communication technology that we've never had before. And I often think that, well, actually, people probably said the same when the printing press arrived. You know, you can only compare to what you had before.
Uh-huh.
So at the time, the printing press was amazing and fast and mass communication that we never had before. But one thing you mention here, which I find interesting, is you say it took 30 or 40 years for presses to be in hundreds of cities in 6 different countries, which for the time is fast.
Mm-hmm.
And then 100 years for 8 million books to be printed. And throughout this period of time, you know, there was iterative improvements about what a book meant. And of course, as you said, again, the book itself was not a new concept, but the production of the book was. So I wonder if you think that at the moment, with the kind of computing revolution, are we just in a similar time frame? Sort of, I guess it's about 50 to 60 years later. We're just sort of iterating on the big revolution that happened in the past, and we're maybe waiting for the next step, whatever that might be. And we're just kind of iterating right now.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, the computer is a new medium, like the TV or radio was before. And if you look at all these things, you will find there's a certain time frame where people were exploring that new medium and trying out things. And one of my most famous examples is the story about Orson Welles, the War of the Worlds, where he was broadcasting his story over the radio, and people were thinking it's a real story.
Mm.
And things like this are happening with computers as well. I mean, just look at the last year or the last 2 years, for example, with the Spring Revolution in the Arabic States, for example, with Trump being elected, with the Snowden revelations and so on. So it's interesting times, and you can see that we have no idea yet what to make out of the medium.
Mm.
And we're still in this exploring phase. And my idea is, of course, looking at the printing press and the story you were mentioning before,
yeah.
How can we accelerate this process and make sense of this new medium before it changes us?
Mm.
And the problem I basically have with computers is that it's such a, I mean, the last thing, probably the last new medium which had such an impact was probably the car, maybe, and that took close to 50, 60, 70 years. And with computers, it's so much faster. And I think we have to be really careful right now to not go into the wrong direction, because it will be a basic thing for us, for our culture and for our society.
Hmm. I think it already is. If you want to extrapolate computers into mobile phones as well, then it already is, I think.
Right.
And so what do you consider the wrong direction?
Well, to be honest, I'm quite optimistic. So I think things will work out in the end.
Yeah.
And especially with things like the Trump election or Snowden, those are of course like the strategies of these years. We also have really, really good things happening to us. For example, we can talk right now, even if we're separate by a few hundred kilometers right now. And for example, we can see each other. I can talk to my brother in the US, for example.
Yeah.
I can share my article, my thoughts really easily. And there are really cool things happening right now. And I just think if we just keep it going like this, this will probably be the wrong direction.
Yeah.
And there was a talk by Brett Victor called The Future of Programming. Mm-hmm. His answer was basically, I have to start over. His talk was given in 2013, but he dressed up as a scientist in the 70s. And in that sense, he was showing like the great new project they were doing in the 70s.
Yeah.
And at some point, you figure out that he's actually talking about our time, because not much has changed.
Yeah.
You know, you're still coding in text files line by line, and we're not sharing and collaborating over computers like people imagined back then, and so on. And his end statement was basically this, that with these great new ideas, great new visions and technologies, and it's amazing, and the only sad thing would be if in 40 years we would still program in text files and still do the same things as we do right now.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good answer to your question.
Okay. And actually, I think this is one of the interesting aspects of having this conversation is, generally, if you criticize the status quo, everyone assumes that you're negative. And actually, just pointing out problems doesn't necessarily mean that you think the future is doom and gloom and bleak. and actually, I think in some respects, social networks and the some of the aspects of the modern internet are almost to blame for that you can't criticize anymore without being labeled just a negative person. That's a side topic in some ways, but I'm an optimist too. So despite
I thought your talk was quite optimistic, even though it was quite harsh in its statement.
So and I guess so. If we say that in the 70s we were still coding in text files, and effectively we still are, but just text files with a lot of dressing on. What do you think will be the big leaps forward that could change that? And this could be something that actually is plausible, or something that your own crazy idea that you think could push this to the next level and the next level of developments in the sort of computing space.
So I think a new medium will change how we think and how we can act. Like the car, for example, changed our whole world. We're becoming more mobile. We go to streets. We can go like into vacation, and I can drive to Berlin tomorrow if I want to, and so on. This was not possible before, which also changes how we work, how we live, and so on. And similarly, I think the computer has the possibility to change how we think and how we solve problems. And right now, this is not really happening. Like I know lots of programmers, for example, who solve their own problems.
Yeah.
Like they have, I don't know, a side project, like they need to water their plants, or they need to calculate some things, or they want to track their investments and so on. And they can easily write their own problems. And what I'm missing here is that the average layman can't do that right now.
Mm.
And in my opinion, the computer should help normal people to solve their problems as well. And by doing that, we can actually augment ourselves.
Yeah.
And by doing that, we can invent new and better tools, which in, of course will point us to being even more augmented and so on. And it will result in a, let's say, continual co-evolution.
You actually have an interesting point in your post that I'd like to come to next. But firstly, I think I'm going to challenge you slightly and disagree with you slightly on that point.
Okay.
In that, actually, I feel like there is now technology available for people to be able to do that sort of thing without having to understand coding to a point, like tools like Ift and the sort of drag and drop builder type tools that let you kind of visually program some things. But I think maybe the problem more lies in that a lot of people feel like they can't do that. It's not that the technology doesn't exist, but no one has told them that it exists, or no one has told them that they can use it enough. We kind of build tools. You're right in that we build tools too much for ourselves. And sometimes with the intention of making them accessible to others, but we don't necessarily tell them about it. I don't know. I'm not sure if that makes any sense.
No, it definitely makes it, because my question too would be, does your mom use IFTTF?
Strangely, my dad, actually, I don't have a mother anymore, but my dad actually had a physics and math degree and actually used to program computers back in the 70s and 80s in BASIC. Yeah. And then he personally completely skipped generations. He's now loves his tablet, but trying to get him to use a computer from the 90s or 2000s, he would never touch it.
Right.
But my dad is a bad example, because my dad only does things that he sees a point in. So I get your point, though. My own parents are a bad example, but I get your point. So, again, I think this varies. So I have met older people who are more inquisitive. So I don't know if it's an age thing. It's more of just a mindset. But I think it's education too. A lot of older people obviously have not been through a period of education where they have been encouraged more to challenge and investigate more. And I'm guessing that will change over time as well. So.
I mean, the thing is, even if it's that, we're not making it really easy for those people to learn how to make use of computers, right?
Yeah.
So we're giving them a tricycle, so to say, and teach them to ride a tricycle, but the bicycle would be even faster.
Yeah,
and of course, you need to invest some time to learn that, of course.
Exactly. But, if you're gonna bother to learn to ride a tricycle, why not bother to learn to ride a bike?
Yeah. And here's the interesting thing. If a computer has such an important role in our society, and you will be using computer now until the end of your life, doesn't it make sense to like make some efforts in learning some things and actually making use of the computer?
Yeah. I think the education one is a big aspect. And
definitely, yeah.
I think our favorite tagline of this podcast is, that's a whole other topic. So I'm gonna move on to... another point in your post, you say, let's pose this question. When was the last time using a computer was fun? I find this interesting. I'm not 100% sure if I completely agree with you on the fun aspect. Like, that's it's too much of a loaded question, maybe. But the point I would like to take that you go into more detail later was, when I studied computer science, I actually did a course that was quite interesting, and we had... one module that was at the time taught by the School of Psychology, and it was human-computer interaction, as it was sort of called then. I think now it's more called UX. But and one of the aspects that we got taught that has stuck with me was this concept of abstraction, like making something very complicated actually quite simple. You go into a lot of examples here where... Because you're sort of putting the point of saying that because engineers tend to develop tools, and maybe engineers that have also become product people and things like that, that we have sort of created these tools that we want, i.e. ones that reduce our interactions with humans and dress it up in the guise of efficiency, like you say, about online ordering, driverless cars, online stores, online dating, all these sorts of things where we're basically trying to say we're making it easier, but actually all we've really done is remove humans. And yeah, I'm guessing your perspective is, although you're not explicitly saying that this is good or bad, but so do you think these changes are good or bad, or it varies?
That's an interesting point, because I think technology is always good and bad, not either or. So every new technology brings within good sides and bad sides, and there's never only good sides. And if you're talking about Amazon, about driverless cars, about online stores, social media, we can talk a lot about the good things they bring us. What I'm missing and what I'm trying to point to here was that we are not looking at the bad sides, you know? So, for example, I had an example of the online dating thing where we have like apps like Tinder, OkCupid, or whatever, which actually have a real impact in that people don't actually talk to each other in a bar or in a street anymore. Because everyone is thinking like, oh, I'll get like the next girl or guy over my Tinder account. And it's a placative example, but we're not looking at the bad side here, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the thing I'm missing in here.
Yeah, no, I sort of agree with you there. I think I can't talk much for the online dating because I've been married for nearly 10 years. So to be honest with you, if I was single tomorrow, I wouldn't know what to do anymore. Like the world has so completely changed in that space. But some of the others, I think the driverless cars one is an interesting one because on the positive, it opens up driving to people who couldn't drive before for various reasons. But on the negative, yeah, it will destroy a lot of interactions with businesses that we currently have to interact with. Stores are the same. I mean, the positive is you can get anything at any time, which, to be honest with you, in the past few years, every time I've ever tried to go and find something on a high street, I've never been able to find it. So, you know, it solves that. But at the same time, of course, you reduce those interactions again, and it's very easy to put yourself into those worlds. We all do it because it's easier in some respects. People are difficult.
And this is a great example by Neil Postman, where he gave a talk about this topic, and he was like, his opinion was not that technology is good or bad, but he was trying to point out nuances between those. And he made the example that, let's suppose it's 1905 and the car was just invented, and you would now make a list of positive things and negative things. Positive side, you would put up like mobility, and you can visit your grandma, and you can travel to work, and you can go on vacations, and so on. And the bad side would be, I don't know, pollution, car jam, traffic accidents, a restructuring of cities, and so on. And then after putting up this list, thinking about like, do we actually want this technology? And if we want it, how can we reduce the bad side of it?
Yeah.
And this is a conversation we're not having at all.
That's a very good point.
Social media, computers, and so on.
I think firstly, it's important to point out that this is not new, of course. There have always been people questioning advances in technology. I actually heard a fascinating one a couple of days ago on a podcast of when they introduced phone numbers. Because in the past, when you wanted to call someone, you rang up an operator, you had a human interaction, and they put you through. And there was this whole revolution against phone numbers where people would use them incorrectly or they would say them wrong. They claimed a lot of the things we're claiming now against the phone number. And of course, you know, now we're at a point where do you even remember phone numbers? So it's gone completely the other way. But I think possibly what has changed, which is possibly what you're saying, is that it has become, because of some of these advancements, especially things like social media and filter bubbles, it's become harder to criticize. And I think that is actually an important change, maybe. Or maybe we're being too presumptuous here in that in our lifetimes, the two of us and people a little bit older and younger than us have seen this change. But to be honest, if we actually look at the past, how easy was it for anyone to criticize changes to the status quo? And maybe we're just resisting change to what we've got used to. So
Well, it's easier and harder at the same time. Yeah. Like if you look at Galileo, he had to renounce his things. This won't happen anymore. On the other hand, now the challenge probably like you'll be ignored or a Twitter shitstorm will rise over you. So at least he won't be killed anymore. So that's a plus, definitely.
Well, certain arguments in certain parts of the world.
Definitely, definitely. At least not talking about computers, he will be not crucified.
Maybe. I don't know. I think.
Actually, you're right. You just have to look at Snowden.
It
was the same thing, right?
I was listening to, another podcast episode just before I was speaking to you about... I guess it's not, you're not going to be, have your life threatened by talking about computers, but you certainly get your life threatened talking on them. That's for sure.
Definitely.
And that's a whole aspect in itself for this polarization around opinions and communities is an aspect in itself. The positive was that we enabled people who couldn't find each other before to communicate, but that's also the negative.
Correct.
Because previously they didn't know about each other.
And that's actually a really interesting point, because I don't think that people working at Facebook, Google and so on, that they don't have any morale or whatever. I don't think that's the issue at all. They're spending a lot of time thinking about the good parts, but only about the good parts.
Exactly. I completely agree with you there. That's certainly a good point. And I think we need sort of anti-product people. We have the product people who sit around saying, this is what I want people to accomplish. And we need the anti-product people who sit there saying, yeah, but what if this happened?
that's a good word, actually, if you remember this one.
Anti-product. I mean, anti-product manager. I don't know. Maybe we could start a website.
That would be really cool.
And then I guess you wrap up with, maybe you don't wrap up, but there's a sort of nice quote as well towards the end of this article from Douglas Engelbart, who was an intriguing person in himself. Like, he was innovating on things that only now we're starting to see actually realized. And I strongly recommend everyone looks up on your search engine of choice, like the was it the mother of all demos?
It's an amazing demo, especially if you put it in context of the time when it was done.
Exactly. And the quote you've mentioned from him is, these days the problem isn't how to innovate, it's how to get society to adopt the good ideas that already exist. And he probably said this 30 years ago as well. And this is true. And if we want to take it down to a micro level, you've already mentioned things like JavaScript frameworks. I mean, it's a classic joke almost, but it's true. I mean, we have the ability now to collaborate on software, especially with open source, and yet people keep reinventing the wheel. Why not collaborate to improve something that exists? Why do we keep creating new alternatives instead?
Wasn't that in your talk where you were talking about not doing actual real world problems, but creating a new photo sharing app or something like that?
Probably. Probably. And there are reasons behind all this, of course.
Of course,
because we'd like to prove that we're better than other people. Some of it's just because money, there's various reasons why we keep reinventing the wheel.
Definitely.
And you've quoted a couple of times from Steve Jobs, and Apple is a classic company of this. They never really invented much new. They just iteratively improved what was already there.
Right.
They had members of staff in the mother of all demos. So you sort of see where that began. I mean,
even Alan Kay works for Apple for some time. So like really those kind of people in there thinking about how they can make sense of computers and actually create a real world product out of those ideas.
For sure. So, I mean, I said offline that we would keep this conversation to half an hour. We've already gone half an hour, and I think I got about three quarters through your post. So what would be a closing thought or comment, if you've missed anything that you would like to make sure is mentioned?
Well, I think the most important thing is that we shouldn't stop looking around for other and better ways of doing things. Because if we do that, we stop being open up about alternative ways of thinking. Mm-hmm. And that would be the real tragedy in here. Okay. As you said before, the ideas are out there, possible solutions, visions, everything is out there. And you can even invent new things. But if you just follow the traveled path, nothing new will come out of it.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, so just to wrap up with something more practical, what are you working on at the moment that's sort of exciting you, and how can people stay in touch with you and find out more from you?
Thanks so much for asking. So As I said, I'm helping companies to attract better and more and better clients by actually thinking how to improve their digital processes. Mm-hmm. So I'm going a lot into IT marketing and business strategy. And you're very welcome to follow my newsletter where I talk about these topics. Of course, you're very welcome to have a look at both talks. They're both on my website, and I'm sure we can share the links to those. Mm-hmm. And next year, I probably won't do another talk, but I got an idea of like a small prototype I want to develop.
And,
you can certainly stay in touch with me over my website, newsletter, or if you feel so, I'm always looking forward to receive emails from people.
Whilst that would have been a very nice point to end, I actually just want to pick up on what you said there, because it was interesting because we both did talks of this kind of nature at this particular conference. And mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm assuming you also read the feedback from attendees. And one of the feedback points was less lectures. So, you know, I think this is interesting in that there's a few people in this space trying to have these discussions. And actually my wife was at an event on Friday, an entire organization. And I've even also come across the Tech Workers Collective, which is another organization kind of looking into some of these sorts of other issues. But we all know, if anyone who's been an activist in the past or anyone who's ever tried to change someone's opinion, that you often spend a lot of your time preaching to the converted, unfortunately. That is a whole other conversation again. But
I mean, these are really, really hard
problems,
and hard things to think about. And I get it that many people don't have the time to do that.
Yeah, or it's too intangible. I think this has been always one of the concepts about global warming and climate change as well, is that people find it hard to grasp onto what it means and what they can actually do about it, whereas the smaller kind of more concrete things are easier to...
And this is definitely a thing we can improve on.
Yeah,
and exactly. We're not giving like these long talks or lectures, as you said, and provide more meaningful, actionable things, of course.
So it's our own fault. Okay. No, and I understand what you mean, and I think that's always the best way, is to just sneak in kind of like Trojan horses into other talks and things like that. Yeah, I think that's probably always been my best bit of advice, especially coming from kind of my more activist history as well, is the big kind of grandiose gestures only get you so far, but you actually just need to do little bit by little bit by little bit by little bit, and it's actually often the best way to change people's opinions in the long run. Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time. And,
well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, always interesting to have these sorts of conversations. So thanks again.